This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 1st of July 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 156, with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Hugo MacDonald.
On this week's show, our very own Steve sits down for a special interview with Alistair Campbell. Tony Blair's former right-hand man visited Monocle 24 earlier this week to discuss events leading to the Iraq War.
I was very conscious of the fact that my politics are very different to theirs, no doubt. I did find George Bush very different to them. Now, maybe I was wrong, I don't know.
And we'll be speaking with Billy Cahora, nominee for this year's Kane Prize. The ceremony takes place tomorrow, and it's a celebration of the best in African writing.
All that, and of course some great, great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly, on Monocle 24.
Hello, Hugo MacDonald.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
Very good. Very excited, because this was the week when summer finally began.
I know, but it came with a vengeance in London and we're all drowning in muggy sweat.
Speak for yourself.
Well, it's very nice to be in the studio where there's air conditioning.
There is. And lots of people were sporting shorts this week, were
indeed,
they not?
I broke out my legs for one of the first times this year.
You did indeed, yes.
It's always so embarrassing though, because it takes me a long time to tan. Once I tan, then it's there for a while. But I haven't really got around to it yet, so I'm fairly luminous.
Are you sort of worried about that first week when everyone dons shorts and there's Brazilians upstairs?
I know, and you pluck up the courage to put your shorts on and you come into work and everybody spends the whole time still looking at your legs with slightly raised eyebrows thinking, gosh, that's brave.
You're Scottish.
I know. I know, at least I've got quite nice stiff legs that are used to being shown with a kilt in Scotland.
Ah, right. I wonder where that was leading. Do you have a kilt?
Of course I do.
Do you have a family kilt?
Yes.
Really?
Me and my father share the same tartan. In fact, we're the only ones that are allowed to wear that tartan. But Prince Charles chooses to wear it.
Really?
Yeah, there's a dispute over the title.
Oh, a dispute between Prince Charles and you?
Yeah.
Over who should wear that tartan?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Lord of the Isles, check it out.
There's a whole show just in this.
No, we've actually got a whole show ahead of us, which is much more exciting than my father's tartan.
Well, yes, no, we do indeed. And it's a very busy time as well at Midori House for us, because we're almost putting the finishing touches to Mediterranean.
Steve.
I like to say Mediterranean.
No, I think...
Is it wrong?
Yeah, I think definitely.
Okay, the Med.
In Monocle on Med.
Monocle on Med.
The annual summer newspaper.
Exactly. We go into production with that next week, and we've all been off on interesting trips, have you not?
Various jaunts, haven't we? I know this time last week I was in the Costa Smeralda in Sardinia.
Very nice.
And you were doing, or you took in three countries in 3 hours or something.
Pretty much, yes. I went on a road trip from Croatia through Slovenia and ending in Trieste in Italy. And the reason being because Slovenia has the shortest coast in all of Europe, just 30 miles, a mere 46 kilometres of coastline.
I can't wait to read how, well, we won't give too much away, obviously. But do you feel like you're passing through a different country in those 30 miles? Or
yeah, it really does feel slightly different. Slovenia still feels very slightly different from Croatia, and then Italy obviously feels slightly different from Slovenia. You really do get a sense of that. But it happened so quickly. We were sort of looking for a turn off for a small town. It was like, oh, it's here. And of course it is, because it's only a 30-mile stretch.
Do they pack a lot of nice hotels and villas into that 30-mile stretch?
It's not that sort of touristy yet,
right,
which is quite good. You get a lot of a few Italians coming over the border because it's a lot cheaper. A lot of Germans and Austrians looking for a bit of coast, Adriatic coast, and then on either side of the Slovenian Croatian side, people swap, Croatians in Slovenia, Slovenians in Croatia, that sort of thing. So everyone seems very friendly about it all. It's all very nice.
I look forward to reading more.
I do recommend, as a travel tip, going back there. And also, when we were in Italy, we were not the only Monocle editors there. There was at one stage six Monocle editors all in Italy at the same time.
I know, and we were quite evenly spread out geographically as well. From me all the way down in Sardinia, and Tyler across the coast in Amalfi. And then Sophie was up on the Tuscan coast. You were in Trieste.
Yeah.
And Jonathan and Aisha were in Milan.
They were. And Take as well was in Milan.
Yes. And yeah, Ivan was a little bit further north as well, doing another story for Mediterraneo.
All these things. Buy Mediterraneo when it comes out on sale, which is end of July.
Yes, there's more than just stories about Italy in there.
Yes, yes, there are indeed. We go to Libya, we go all over the place. But anyway, that is still to come. Still to come on this show, we're going to be talking about Iraq. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. It's been nearly a decade since the war in Iraq drew up an all-new political landscape, both in the West and in the Middle East. With the conflict only having reached some kind of resolution last year, it's an issue rarely far from the media's eye. But one person for whom Iraq will forever be a personal challenge is Alistair Campbell, former press secretary for Tony Blair and a figure at the heart of the UK government during the run-up to the war. His new book, The Burden of Power, Countdown to Iraq, chronicles his diaries from that time. And earlier this week, here at Midori House, I spoke with Alistair Campbell to find out why questions about the war just won't go away. Alistair Campbell, thank you very much for
my pleasure
coming into Midori House. I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Because in the view of the British government, Saddam Hussein was a threat. And I think there's a line in the book where I say to Tony, look, if this brings about your, as it were, premature end politically, which it might, is it really worth it? And he said, I think something that I think guided him the whole way through. He said, look, it's always worth doing what you think is the right thing. And Saddam has been ignored for far too long. And that includes by Britain. And it's interesting. One of the benefits of keeping a diary is that you can recall things that you can't remember. I had completely forgotten that the day before September the 10th, we went for lunch at the Guardian, and it was Mike White who reminded me that day... That day, Tony had said, the big coming issue is rogue states, weapons of mass destruction and terrorist organisations. Now, that was September the 10th. So I think, you know, as lots of people said at the Chilcot Inquiry, Saddam had been not tolerated, but people had turned a blind eye. And the phrase that kept being used was the calculus of threat had changed. Where before people were willing to take a risk on doubt, now they weren't. And when I say people, I mean particularly the Americans, but also us and other countries that were in the alliance that then took him out.
But despite all that, you were still, the government was still willing to accept that Saddam Hussein could stay in power. It was the fact that he had weapons of mass destruction that was the main issue.
Well, I think if Saddam Hussein, even at the last, even before just before the military action began, if he had credibly signalled that he intended to stand by his international obligations, then I think, could war have been averted? I think possibly. But I think by then, his record was so clear, his message of defiance was so clear, it kind of wasn't going to happen. And but, you know, this is why I always defend Tony in relation to what he did. And I think the diary makes this clear. What you don't see in there is a guy kind of champing at the bit to go to war. What I think you see is somebody really trying his level best to use the considerable power and influence that he had to stop war. But that depended on Saddam doing certain things, which as time went on, it became clear he just wasn't going to do.
You made a very clear moral argument about Iraq that, you know, this was a guy that had killed a million of his own people, had gassed his own people at Halabja, had all sorts of other nefarious links. This was a bad guy, a dictator, and the world would be a better place if he wasn't ruling Iraq. Given all that, why wasn't the UK government in favour of regime change?
I think once military action began, it was about regime change. Once military action began, it wouldn't end until he was, as it were, toppled. There's, again, sorry to keep plugging the book here, but I'm referring to what's in it. The absolute truth is that there was a mix of those arguments going on the whole time. The reason why he was a unique threat in Tony's eyes was, as you just said, because he'd used weapons of mass destruction before against his own people, because of the history. You see, what our critics try to do is say, oh, well, you know, you just wanted to do it because George Bush wanted to do it, and 9/11 gave you the sort of pretext and the excuse, and so you dreamed up this whole WMD thing. This is the kind of conspiracy theory that goes against us. I mean, I just say to people, go and read all the United Nations resolutions going way back. And when you talk about regime change, I mean, the Clinton administration had a policy of regime change. Bush, as it were, inherited that. It's just that the Clinton regime didn't pursue that to its logical conclusion.
But I'm saying the UK government view wasn't that regime change was necessary.
It wasn't. The UK government view was that, one, he had to be made to face up to his international obligations under the UN resolutions of which he'd been in defiance. That he was a particular threat because of weapons of mass destruction. That is true. Now, as has been thrown back at us millions of times with some justification, we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction after he fell. Now, my view on that is the intelligence can't all have been wrong. And what the other thing to remember is we know that he had them, and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that. But the point about the threat that we were dealing with was that, and why Tony was so concerned about this, was because, and I can remember him saying, I don't want to be the Prime Minister who wakes up one day and finds that what we're warning about now, this coming together of weapons of mass destruction, rogue states and terrorist groups, that it happens on his watch, and we warned about it, but we didn't actually act on it. So I think the acting on it was obviously, clearly it was a big decision and a difficult decision, and it's still very, very unpopular. I know that. But it's one of those things where you're not taking that decision in hindsight. He was taking that decision then, where the intelligence was pointing in a very clear direction. And, okay, that's all been unpicked, and you've had the Butler inquiry, you've had the Chilcot inquiry. But even with all that, I still support what Tony Blair did. Having seen him dealing with the decision at that time, not now in hindsight, but then.
To go back to that time, so not dealing with hindsight, but you know, what other people were saying at the exact same time. You had people like Robin Cook saying, well, look, if we can't, on the one hand, say Saddam is a very serious threat, and at the same time also say this is going to be a walk in the park, it'll be over in a few weeks, that his military is so weak now that we can take him without...
People weren't saying that. On the contrary. In fact, one of the reasons why it became so difficult afterwards was actually because Saddam's machine collapsed much more quickly than we thought it would. And what's more, that there was no... We thought there'd be at least a sort of structure of government there. There wasn't.
Well, arguably there was, and it was only when all Ba'ath Party officials were sacked.
Well, there was certainly a process of de-Ba'athification, and there was an argument about whether that didn't go far enough. So, I mean, again...
But, I mean,
all of these
things, what's your argument on that? So, just on that point...
Well, you can look at all of these things and say, well, could have been done differently. But,
well,
I mean,
yes.
But the criticism at that time was that we weren't going far enough. And actually, there were too many of the Saddam people still left in positions. But the point that I'm making, there wasn't that structure. So the things that we were worried about, I mean, one of the most, there's a passage in that book where I still, if when I read it, I kind of get the hairs on my neck standing up because I remember it so vividly, was when we went over to the MOD for a briefing. And one of the subjects on the agenda was the preparedness of our troops should they come under attack from chemical and biological weapons. Now, there wasn't a person in that room who didn't believe that that was a real threat. And there's two things I'd like to say about that. One, no prime minister would ever commit troops into that situation that was being described if he didn't really think he had to. That's the first point. And the second point is, we believe that threat to be real. So when the military action began, there were lots of things that we thought could have happened that didn't. One of them, we thought he might fire off chemical and biological weapons. He didn't. The other, we thought that there would be this sense of a functioning structure waiting to step up to the mark when Saddam went. It didn't happen. We thought that we were worried about the potential of an environmental catastrophe. One of the first things that our forces were involved in was it's all about oil, was making the oil fields safe so that he didn't launch an environmental catastrophe to cause absolute chaos on the markets. So the things that were planned for in a way, went better on the military side than had been expected. And the things that we thought would go wrong turned out to be different. One of which, and this is the thing that really prolonged it, we hadn't properly predicted or thought through the consequences of Iran and Al-Qaeda pouring people in there and pouring resources in there to prolong in the way that they did.
Why hadn't you?
Well, I don't. You'd have to ask the intelligence people that who were giving the advice. And...
Because, I mean, that is one of the things that comes up time and again, is that there was obviously a lot of thought given to how the war started.
Yeah.
I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but, you know, how you get to this situation where it is dealt with.
Mm.
You know, you talk about that a lot in your diaries. There's very little in anyone's books about what happened pre-2003, and including from what I've seen so far in yours, about, okay, if this does happen, what happens next?
No, there was a hell of a lot of planning went on, but you've got to remember, this is my diary, okay, and I'm the guy who's in charge of communications and strategy, so it's coming at it from a very different position. I was doing a talk the other night at one of the universities in London, and there were a couple of guys there came to see me afterwards who'd been involved in on the intelligence side, on planning and analysis, and all that was going on. There was, but my point is that everybody knows this happens in military conduct. It doesn't sort of say, nothing ever goes totally according to plan.
Mm.
If I think back of some of the other situations we were involved in, Kosovo, which is now sort of thought to have been a great success for all sorts of reasons. But actually, at the time, lots of things went wrong, including refugees being bombed, including the Chinese embassy being bombed. I mean, things happened that were, as it were, totally unplanned, which you had to deal with. My point, and when you say, why didn't we predict that Al-Qaeda would have kind of poured in their resources there? Because at the time, the analysis was that the threat that they were going to pose would have been an attempt to provoke a reaction here or in America, or in some of the other capitals of the countries that were involved. That's just, and if you think about it, that's a fairly obvious thing to have thought. And so my point is that you deal with the unexpected, but on that big picture, to go back to your very, very first question, was there deemed to be a threat that had to be taken seriously? Yes, there was. And also, let me say this, that people in Britain in particular, less so in America, but particularly in Britain, there's a sense of this just being seen as a negative. But two things. I mean, the same event I did at the university, there was an Iraqi guy there. You never hear these guys on the media because the media don't want to talk to them. But I meet them a lot. And they will say, if you're speaking to Tony Blair, will you thank him for what he did? There are Iraqi people who will say that because they know it's a better country than it was. They've got the beginnings of democracy. You know, Libya, lots happened in Libya recently with Gaddafi and all the rest of it. I am absolutely in no doubt at all that Libya gave up their weapons of mass destruction because they saw the seriousness of intent post 9/11 with which the Americans and others were pursuing Saddam. So it's easy to sort of just look at one bit of it and say, and you know, we have to accept, as everybody has accepted, that things went wrong and that things that, you know, it went on too long, that too many people died who weren't directly involved and so forth. But on that big picture, did the world ignore Saddam for too long? Yes. Was it the right thing to take him on in the way that we did? I think it was, and I still support what Tony Blair did.
Let's look a bit more at the international angle. There's a bit in your book, Monday, March the 3rd, so coming up very closely to the war itself, where you're talking about the problems on the communications front, which you say was largely caused by US-friendly fire. They looked the whole time like they were desperate for war. We at least didn't look like we were desperate for war, but we did look like we were desperate to be with them. That was obviously sort of a major communications problem for you. How do you think you'd got yourself in that situation?
Well, just by dint of the fact that the Americans were in a different position to us. They had a policy of regime change. They didn't believe, for example, that we needed to go back to get another resolution at the United Nations. Now, it was Tony Blair who persuaded George Bush to do that. And one of the most extraordinary meetings I've ever been involved in was when Tony Blair was effectively being used by George Bush to persuade George Bush's vice president to do something he didn't want to do, Dick Cheney. And that was extraordinary because Cheney just kind of, I remember, there was a discussion afterwards about how we were going to announce this. And I mean, Bush was being very kind of his usual sort of hail fellow, well met. And Cheney just looked absolutely kind of miserable and angry.
Did you feel, I mean, you're, yeah, if you don't mind me saying, a bit of a lefty. Did you feel a little bit uncomfortable being not just on the same side, but in the same bed as the likes of Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz?
Well, I never went to bed with them. uncomfortable. I felt at times, I mean, people, my left-leaning friends find it very shocking when I say I actually quite like George Bush.
No, I know you've said that in the past, I mean, that's why I was more asking about the,
yeah,
about the others.
And I think I was always conscious of the fact that he was the president. I did feel uncomfortable sometimes with Cheney and I mean, I describe in the book various points where Rumsfeld just, you know, said things and you thought, does he ever think through what he says? And so, yeah, at times I think I did probably feel a bit uncomfortable. I remember once I went to Washington with Jack Straw. He talked about the communications and what we call the communications friendly fire. And I went and tried to persuade and successfully persuaded Condi Rice and Karen Hughes, the communications director, and others, that we had to improve our coordination with them, but that meant they had to improve their coordination internally. And I gave them a paper and a plan. And Jack and I ended up having a discussion with Cheney about it. And he was a very hard guy to talk to. He basically just said, yeah, well, I've read your thing and it's fine and I think you should get on with it. And then we sort of sat there with Jack making diplomatic speak while... And it was, I was very conscious of the fact that my politics are very different to theirs, no doubt. But I think that's why I did find George Bush very different to them. Now, maybe I was wrong, I don't know. But I found him much more likeable, much more personable, very easy to talk to, very self-deprecating. And, you know, whereas, yeah, with Cheney, you felt you were in the presence of somebody on the... very much on the other side of the ideological fence.
Leaving aside the rights or wrongs of the Iraq War, there's an argument that two of the big things that Tony Blair wanted to achieve, Britain part of a stronger Europe, more united with Europe, and also all sorts of domestic reforms in welfare and schools and in health and so on, took a bit of a battering by the Iraq War. The reforms, because your entire second term agenda was pretty much... not put to one side, but overshadowed somewhat. The European project affected quite deeply by the fact that there was a very clear split. Is that fair?
No, not entirely. The first thing to say is that when... there were lots of times, not just in relation to Iraq, but Kosovo, sometimes when the European Union was the dominant issue, there were lots of times when if Tony as Prime Minister was really focused on foreign policy, and maybe this was a consequence of the extent to which we were seen as driving everything from the centre. But I think sometimes there was a danger that some departments took their foot off the accelerator and just thought, oh, well, it's all about foreign affairs, we can coast. In fact, that's the time when you shouldn't be coasting. That's the time when you should really be pushing on the domestic agenda. He did get very frustrated at times with the sense of reform not going as fast and as deep as he would have liked. But I would still argue we did a hell of a lot. When Tony wrote his own book, A Journey, I was quite surprised the extent to which his assessment of our first term, for example, was that, you know, he felt we could have done a lot more. I'm not sure we could have done that much more. There's only so many bills you can get through. There's only so much legislative change you can make. And I think the first term was terrific. The second term, obviously, foreign policy took a much bigger space, share of his time. And yeah, he did get frustrated at times with the pace of reform. I think on Europe, it was a tricky one because at times I think Tony did think that Gordon was... You see, if you go back a bit, if you wind back a few years, when I was a journalist and I knew them both very, very well, I would have put Gordon as more pro-European than Tony, way back. And then there was a kind of swap over at some point. I don't quite know when it happened. I think Tony's still very, very pro-European and thinks that one day Britain could and should be part of a big European currency, whether it's the euro or it's something that's going to evolve out of the current mess, I don't know. He at points, I think, was feeling that Gordon's very strong opposition was in part driven by Tony's very strong support as opposed to an actual assessment. Now, I don't think that's necessarily right. I think I was always probably a bit closer to Gordon on the euro. I mean, again, as with, I would do Tony's bidding and that was my job. But I sort of think if you were to hold a referendum in Britain now, who was right? Mm. I don't think there's any doubt who would win.
Yeah, it'd be pretty clear who would win. Yeah. I wanted to ask about Gordon Brown. It's very hard to look at Brown and Blair together and the things they've said and the things they've pushed for and really find politically too many differences between them.
No, I think that's right.
So then, what was the problem?
Oh, my God. I think... I don't know. Look, Tony became leader in 1994. I think the day before John Smith died, if you'd have taken a poll of most people in the Labour Party, who's the leader of the Labour Party, most people would say Gordon Brown. But that was because it wasn't a decision that had to be taken. And sometimes what happens when the decision has to be taken, people come to a different view. And on the day John Smith died, it was kind of obvious. Once the question became real rather than theoretical, a different answer emerged. I think Gordon struggled with that thereafter. Now, just to speak in his defence, as I do, a lot of the best things that we did as a government, we did because Gordon Brown was pushing for them. The times when we were at our best were when Tony, John Prescott, Gordon, Peter Mandelson, myself, the people on the strategy side of things, were all really motoring together. When that was happening, we were completely unstoppable. It was like... You know, without boasting, it was like us against the Tories was like Barcelona against Wigan.
Burnley,
yeah. Yeah, it was. I felt we were unstoppable when we were all on song. And the tragedy is that as time went on, it became harder and harder to keep everybody.
But why is that? If there weren't any real political differences.
There were some big political differences. I mean, I think.
Really? Like what?
Well, we've mentioned one.
Well, the Euro. Yes, but I mean, the Euro wasn't
But also,
there.
No, in relation to, within this volume of the book, of the diaries, for example, the public service reform, and one of the biggest arguments was over the business of foundation hospitals. So that was a big public service reform that Tony Blair and Alan Milburn were really, really pushing for, and Gordon didn't like it at all. He writes a 44-page letter to all other ministers explaining why this is a bad idea. That was a proper division.
Do you think it was actually a proper division? I mean, if he was asked to recall any of those reasons in that 44-page letter now, the differences between him and Tony Blair.
You'd have to ask him that. But I do think that what had happened by then was that in a sense, a lot of politics is about, and a lot of leadership is about instinct. And within the Labour Party, within the Parliamentary Labour Party in particular, by then, people didn't kind of know what their instincts were meant to be because there were these two poles of power. Now, Tony was the Prime Minister. He was still, even with Iraq, he was still pretty popular by Prime Ministerial third terms, going for third term standards. And he won a third election. But a lot of MPs were kind of thinking, how long is this guy going to be around for? Gordon seems to have a different position. They didn't know what their instincts were meant to be. It's a bit like with the coalition now. You know, they don't really know. The Tories don't know what they're meant to think. And, you know, the tragedy is, I remember even Clare Short, you've read the book and I don't particularly like Clare Short and I never really did. But I remember her once saying, look, why is there all this division out there? Because actually this is the most united cabinet any of us can remember. And that was true. But a lot of these divisions became really difficult, really quite visceral. But when push came to shove, 2005 election, Tony and Gordon campaigned together a fair bit. 2010, we all went back to help. So there's still a lot more that unites than divides, but it was, I'm not denying it wasn't difficult at times.
One thing, Steve, actually, that didn't come across in that fascinating interview was the fact that Alistair Campbell was actually dressed head to toe in Lycra cycling gear, wasn't he?
He was. Not quite, in fact, head to toe. It was cycling shorts.
There was a lot of leg. More legs than me?
More legs than you, yes. Maybe not quite as much leg as you. and cycling top, yes. He was. He'd been cycling all over London and sort of.
Was this just a cunning ruse to try and throw you off your questioning?
As cunning ruses go, is perhaps not a bad one.
No, exactly. Who just thought Alistair Campbell and sweaty or not? No.
Let's not get into that.
Okay.
Should we play some music?
Let's just play a song then, shall we? I don't know if you know of this band. They're a great, still a bit youngish, but very successful hipster pop band from Toronto called Dragonette.
And I don't know.
This is Easy. And that was Easy by Dragonette. You enjoyed it, I think.
I did enjoy that, yeah. Good. I really like them. They're great.
Yeah, they're great. Well, you should check them out more. Except they had, I think, one of the biggest selling singles of last year was called Hello, which you'll definitely recognise when you hear it on iTunes. And it is absolutely murderously annoying. So bar that small blip, Dragonette were big fans of. Yes. Anyway, you're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Tomorrow night, some of Africa's finest writers will be gathering together in Oxford for the Kane Prize ceremony. The £10,000 award is given each year and has become known as the African Booker Prize for celebrating short stories from the continent.
To talk to us more about the health of African fiction, we're joined today by one of the nominated writers, Billy Kahora, who is also the editor of Kwani, the Kenyan literary journal. Billy, a very warm welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Quite all right. Let's start by looking more generally at the state of African fiction at the moment. There's, most people can name numerous African writers, but they don't tend to have necessarily been published originally on the continent, do they?
No, not particularly. No, not really.
And why is that? What's the problem with publishing in Africa?
Pure economics, mostly. I think that it happens in two ways. First and foremost, because you don't have the markets, which means you don't have the industry. And books are produced from an assembly line or combination. It's almost like asking, like, how come Africa buys all these cars, but none of them are produced in Africa, so, or Kenya for that matter, or Tanzania. It's purely first and foremost at that point about economics. And then, of course, if you don't have like kind of that weird demand supply, you don't have the capacities and skills. So what also happens is that even when you have like small markets, you just don't have the energies, capacities and supply. And it's as simple as that. So, yeah.
So do you find that, because there's obviously an awful lot of fascinating writing happening all across the continent. Are you finding it quite difficult to try and find outlets for that?
Actually, good question. I think that like at the time, like whenever you feel that there are not enough books or there are not enough products coming from creative expression, what's interesting is that that seems to be the time of most creativity informally. So I always feel that like in the 90s when I was in my teens, that there was a huge, huge outpouring of like stories like spoken in pubs, in churches, and people would always gossip, and the gossip and rumor were big. And you're just like, once you start thinking structurally as a writer about this stuff, just like, this stuff, man, it's there. Why can't we just translate it? So it's also about that, it's not so much that the stuff isn't there, but the question is, how do you systemize it? The content is not an issue.
And is that... sort of the principle why you founded Kwani?
Yeah. It came from the idea that there are people who would actually like have an idea of structure and an idea of form. So when Binyavanga Inaina, the editor, founded this, he was always like, let's meet, let's formalize this, because he lived in South Africa. And then he was meeting all these guys in civil society or artists who are also in some little bubble, who had been reading, who had been educated, and were always like, let's formalize this. So and the idea was purely based on that we are trying to systemize this or register this, but obviously it was built off the energy that was coming and what was directly observable. So you can have a place where you have like a weird kind of intelligentsia or structure that don't feel there's anything to actually be done. Or you can have huge informal creative systems that don't have a space or kind of formal structure to try and put that. And that's happened and over time. But I think both models are not different from anything that's ever come from anywhere. Because even here, before English became a written language, this is back in the 1500s, you're all writing in Latin, right? And the French were writing in Latin. Then you just actually decided, why should we do this? And we have this outpouring of energy. And then you start creating the structures around it. So that's what happened.
And have you found over the decades since Kwani was set up that, you know, you've been publishing a literary journal, you've been publishing some fantastic pieces of writing. Has that had a broader impact on on the publishing industry in East Africa in general?
Yeah. But what's actually interesting is that you go through a couple of things. So immediately, when you decide to make the move right, to structure this, you're dealing with lots of material and lots of information, so you're excited. And then you actually reach a kind of like a dip, and you start going and you're like, okay, we've done this, we've done 3 journals, we've done 4 journals. Then you're like, oh, come on, we need to move on to something else. And you go through this kind of existential thing. And as an editor, I feel that when we did the last Kwani, which was in 2010, end of 2010, I was just like, I can't get anything that's new or funky or interesting. And I tend to go through this existential thing. And that has a lot to do with when I talk to people who are writing or I'm writing myself, I'm just like, okay, we've done all this now. What happens to the new forms, the new experimentation? What is the new next exciting idea? Because you feel you've kind of exhausted it. And there's that. But there's also that. There's also other forms. And I think other forms, and Kwani doesn't give enough credit to being informed by music, or being informed by videography, or being informed by very many other things. So this is all that thing. So to answer your question, it's complex and, yeah.
We're going to talk a little bit more, but first of all, we're going to play a little bit of music. This is Mufumu by The Very Best, who are from Malawi, and this is from their album, The Warm Heart of Africa.
That was Mufumu by The Very Best from their album The Warm Heart of Africa. And we still have Billy Kahora in the studio with us here on the Monocle Weekly. Billy, you are nominated for the Kane Prize, which takes place tomorrow night. Tell us a little bit about the Kane Prize. We referred to it in the queue earlier as the African Booker Prize. Is that fair?
Interestingly, I think the Kane Prize has actually revived the short story form, especially during its early years. So a lot of what are considered the good and great African contemporary writers actually are directly very linked to the Kane Prize. So what he did when he came around in around 2001, 2000, it really injected the idea of the short form. But it also injected it was significant enough, not only in terms of money, but in terms of the marketing for a lot of creative people or people who are leaning towards writing to actually get into it. And it's done very many things. In fact, I always say that if you did a study of all these guys who've been shortlisted, or the guys who've won and what they've done after that, or how much of an economy or an industry it's kind of generated in terms of just its announcing. At some point, I think the Kane Prize was so significant that a lot of kids, a lot of emerging writers, people like me included, were only writing for the Kane Prize. So the deadline is January 30th, and people are actually writing for the prize.
deadline.
It becomes like a deadline. And then what happened is that, interestingly, that other spaces now took over the novel form. Bigger deals started happening in America. But make no mistake, like it's in after 2-3 years, after people like Binyavanga won, it became very significant, especially like I think in Kenya.
Well, I wanted to ask, I mean, is it particularly strong in Kenya? Because you say, you know, Binyavanga Wainaina, who was the original editor of Kwani, won 10 years ago. Parsalo Kantai was nominated as well a few years ago.
Yeah.
You know, you're following a long line of writers from Kenya who've been nominated for this prize.
Yeah.
Does that have an impact on you as a writer? You know, living in Nairobi, thinking, well, look, these guys who I know have done it. Well, so can I.
Yeah, like we used to jokingly say, like over whiskeys, when do you join the cane club? I'm there. But the other interesting, the reverse side to that is, we've been, all these people who are being mentioned, all these people who are being talked about, you've actually been on bigger adventures. And a Kenyan writer asked me about this, and he said, is this the thing of most significance between Binyavanga and I? And I'm like, Binyavanga and I have been working for since what is called Kwani 3, which is in 2005. So, like, that's the greatest adventure, being part of Kwani and being together and being peers and growing up in the writing life together. But that is just so entrenched that you actually don't realize it. But it's fantastic that it takes a prize like this to actually realize what you've done with people like Binyavanga for me, or Paselelo. Paselelo is a peer. Paselelo is like somebody who I've done stories with. Paselelo is the one who actually introduced me to assignments and writing in Kenya. So they're
and a brilliant journalist as well.
Completely brilliant. I always tell him, like, you get his shit together, man. He's like, he's an archive by himself. He's very many things. And but it's good for the Kane Prize to be the recognizable space where we have this in common, but we have a lot in common in many other things.
Is it a worry when you look at the African literary scene as a whole that it's taken funding from the Ford Foundation to help establish Kwani? It's the Kane Prize is a UK-based prize. The money comes from here as well. That, you know, there's no lack of money in Africa, and there's there's some very rich publishing houses there, both in terms of newspapers and magazines as well as books as well. Does it worry you that there still isn't enough investment in publishing literature across the continent?
That's a very, very, like, the very many, that's a PhD, that's a whole discourse to just answer that in a straight way. But I'll say a couple of things. Literature is just a way of seeing the world. And I think writing is, especially where I come from. So first and foremost, and I was reading this great interview, was it by, I can't remember who, but it was part of the Paris Review interviews. And they were saying, at times, literature actually thinks it's bigger than it is. But first and foremost, if you're not grabbing the attention, like when you say there's money in Africa, that means the money is with who? Maybe the political and the business class. If writers or the literary class are not grabbing the attention of politicians and all these people, there's an issue. If contemporary writers can't shake things the way I would say an older generation of writers in sub-Saharan Africa did, that's an issue. Because apart from not only shaking them, it means you're not in a kind of mainstream, quote-unquote, national space. That's one reaction. The second thing is that the history of funding and the history of how these things happen is very, very clued into the answer to that question, which is to mean, the arts and culture immediately headbutted each other with politics and economics. And then what happened is that class decided, and they were part of the similar class, they decided, we'll do away with this. So the funders came in, right, to try and put some influence. So that's a good thing. But ultimately, I think the best ground is between those two. Outside funding will always come into the writers and artists, and they've got to balance that. And relevance in terms of a kind of critical idea, political idea, political economical idea. So, yeah.
Good. Well, Billy Cora, thank you very much for coming in indeed. And best
thanks
of luck.
Me.
Yeah, best
thanks.
Of luck tomorrow at the Cane Prize. Yeah. The Cane Prize is announced on Monday. Billy Cora's story is Urban Zoning, which you can find actually from our good friends at McSweeney's, mcsweeneys.net, and you can see all the best new Kenyan writing at Kwani. Billy, thank you very much. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where we don't have really very much left, do we?
No, we don't. That was it. Two fascinating interviews with Alistair Campbell and Billy Cahora.
It couldn't have been more different, really, if they tried, could they?
No, they really couldn't. They really couldn't. It's funny, the last time I saw Billy and also Angela Wachuca, who was in the control room at the back, who's also at Kwani, was in their very lovely gardens in Nairobi, outside their offices in Nairobi. They've got this lovely little sort of bungalow and this huge garden where you see sort of writers sort of lolling underneath trees in the afternoon
writers
sun.
In shorts with legs bared?
Not quite like you, no.
No. Okay, but probably not in cycling gear like Alistair Campbell either.
No, no, not quite. No, no, just lolling and thinking and doing things like that.
You make Nairobi sound so idyllic. Do you miss it?
Lots of it isn't idyllic.
No, of course.
And yes, while we're playing the song, Billy gave the two of us a little bit of an idea of what's going on at the moment. I was like, how's Nairobi? He's like, traffic. yeah, which that bit, I don't miss the traffic at all.
No.
No. But there we are. anyway, that is it for this week's Monocle Weekly. Hugo, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, Steve, thank you.
It was great. The show is produced by Paul Noble. Our researcher, as ever, was Tom Hall. We're going to play you out with the final song. It's going to be Liar Liar by Fine Frenzy. But until next week, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
I'm Hugo McDonald.
Goodbye.